Before we read our passage this morning, we are in the series I call The Villains of Christmas, and we have been kind of in the story where the Magi, Herod is in the story. He's obviously one of the villains of Christmas, and the Magi are the ones that bring the gifts to Jesus. But that's likely well after his birth. Today, we're really in the apex of the story. We're in the heart of it. We're in the spot where Jesus is actually born. And this is the one that actually is in the Charlie Brown Christmas. This is the one Linus quotes from right here in the section in Luke chapter 2 where we are. And so we're in the scene that includes the manger. And we're going to talk a little bit more about what that is today. It's the scene that's iconic. Many of you have manger scenes that are in your home. Denise has one of those. That's part of our Christmas tradition, is to put up the scene where the manger is, where Jesus is born. And I ran across this one this week about a manger and what a family's experienced. Let's take a close look at that. My mom still hasn't noticed. Yoda. Yoda's right there, right next to the baby Jesus. You see that there now? I thought that was rather clever. Kind of just mixed right in right there. I'm wondering how we could sneak things into the manger scene and how long it would take mom to notice that. I don't know. We're in Luke chapter 2, and it starts off in verse 1. And if you have your Bibles open, you can read along as I read this. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Some of your translations say that a census be taken. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house of the lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in the manger because there was no place for them in the inn. We are rightly angry at individuals who somehow don't pay attention to the welfare of others. People who are calloused and don't care if others are injured or hurt or overlooked, somehow are damaged by their own actions, those individuals can somehow bring a level of ire inside of us. I've been reminding you of the villains of Christmas, and there's another that I want to remind you about today, and it's an individual who lacks a level of self-awareness and the effects that he has had upon others. Now, I've also been reminding you that every good Christmas movie has somebody who is the villain. They are the antagonist of the story. And I've got another one I think that matches the story we have today, and I put his picture up here because it is Clark Griswold from A Christmas Vacation, played by Chevy Chase. And you know, that movie is one that is a little cringy for me. You know what I'm saying? It's a little cringy. It's like, it's so awkward that it's sometimes a little difficult to watch because you're like, man, it just feels, yucky. And, you know, at first you'd say, wow, how could you make Clark Griswold the villain of the story? Well, you know, he is the star of the story, but he's also the villain of the story in this way. He has the idea that he is going to make Christmas so special, so over the top good, that he doesn't realize in all of his escapades that he's actually damaging the individuals that are around him. He's got good intentions, but his motivations go from dopey to damaging, from the verbal abuse of his cousin to the outright destruction of his neighbor's property, to the end where he just completely unravels. He is the guy that has this effect upon others, but doesn't necessarily mean it or intend it, but that's what is happening. In today's story, we are going to meet such a person who's so clueless that he makes a pregnant woman have birth in a barn, And he is the innkeeper of the story. And we, you know, he could have given warm shelter, but instead he pushes this young husband and his wife in among the animals. And you're going to hear a little bit more about that in just a minute. As I mentioned earlier, this is the heart of the Christmas story. And while we make our way to the sacred moment of Jesus' birth, I want to take the bird's eye view and follow along in the story to find out what happened, what precipitated this moment, what happened with Mary and Joseph that brought them to this moment, and what happens as the birth of the baby is about ready to arrive. So let's start at the beginning of the story, and the beginning of the story is something that they could have never imagined, some circumstance that brings them to Bethlehem that they never thought would occur, and of course it is the Roman census. So that's where we start in the story, is with the census. The census is called by the guy who is the king of the day. His name is Caesar Augustus. And he is the first Caesar of Rome. He is born with the name Octavian. But he is now, as the first king of Rome, he's given an auspicious title. And the title is Augustus. He is now the Caesar who is Augustus. And Augustus means revered. So Luke is doing something here with us automatically as he's introducing this character. He's saying, here's this guy, the king of the known world, and I'm going to compare him to a king that's born over here in humble circumstance. I'm going to tell you about a king who has the title revered, but I'm going to tell you about the one who's really revered. And so he's painting this contrast with us right from the very beginning. Now, there are reasons why a king would have a census. There's really two primary reasons. One reason, I want to know how many young males are in my realm because I'm conscripting people into the army. The other one is less noble. I want to know how many people there are so I know taxes to expect. And those two were happening in the world at the point at which the census is called. Now, if you're a Jew, you don't worry about being conscripted into the army because as a Roman citizen, you cannot serve in the army. And in fact, you wouldn't even be trusted to be in the army because you're an enemy of the Jews. Or excuse me, enemy of the Rome. As Jews, you're an enemy of Rome. And so again, you don't worry about that. But oh, taxes. Taxes are on their way. And anytime a census is happening, you can be sure that your taxes are going to increase. And so the Roman government calls for a census across all of the world where Rome rules. Now, in Israel, you did not have to, by Roman law, go back to your ancestral lands. Rome never had a law of that. You could have the census anywhere you were, and it didn't make a difference if you were in your hometown. But Rome was known to bend to local customs, and in the Jewish sense, every time you were going to take some sort of census or look into a count of the people, then you had to go back to your ancestral land. And that's what took Mary and Joseph back to Bethlehem, is because Joseph was from the tribe of Judah, and so they had to go back to the spot where their ancestral lands were. And many times the Jews did this because, well, they had their own taxes, like a temple tax, and sometimes that was a head tax. It was on the number of people. And so you were counting individuals by tribe according to the custom in Israel at the time. So Mary and Joseph make their way back. Mary and Joseph obviously travel quite a distance, and they go to Bethlehem. And if you were known at the time too, you were looking at the scriptures, and in fact, Herod even figured this out because the wise men came and said, where's the baby supposed to be born? And the answer was given, Bethlehem. And so if you are a Jew, you know that the Messiah one day will be born in the city of Bethlehem. And this is the verse that deals with that, Micah chapter 5, verse 2. If you want to pull that up for me, it says, but you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Next one, this is verse 4. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. They will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And so if you were a Jew, you knew that this was the promise from the prophets. And so you knew that the baby was going to be born in Bethlehem. So God had to get this young couple into Bethlehem in some way just to fulfill his purposes. Now, Mary and Joseph didn't know, I think, completely what they were fulfilling, but they were fulfilling God's plan at that very moment. They make their trip of about 80 miles, which is probably about a 3 days journey, maybe four. And we have this mental image of Mary riding on a donkey. The scriptures never say that, by the way. All we know for sure is they did a portion of that by foot. And I have a little map here. Again, I put Mary on the donkey. It's, you know, it's probable that they had some kind of an animal, but we're not told that in the scriptures. But here's where they are. All the way up in the Galilee region in a little city of Nazareth, they make their way down, and the easiest path was to avoid the mountains that go from Nazareth all the way to Jerusalem. So they went over by the river, made their way down what's called the King's Highway right there, and then cut across over to into Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem. And so that's the path that they would have taken. Again, about an 80-mile journey. As inconvenient as this was the place for the fulfillment of all God had planned. It was God's destiny. And so they ended up at this space. Although it wasn't ideal, although it wasn't perfect in their minds of the way they had planned it, this is where God would have them. And this is the place where, again, God would fulfill his destiny for Jesus and for Mary and Joseph. Here's what I want you to hear. There are times in our lives when we are in uncomfortable places or uncomfortable positions, but it's part of what God's plan is for us. And that can happen in our lives, and we're like scratching our heads. This doesn't feel good. This doesn't feel right. And yet it is part of God's plan for us to undergo that and to somehow serve him in the midst of that. Today I'd like to introduce you to two ladies. They are Iranian ladies, beautiful young ladies. And they're Miriam and Marizeh. I'm going to have difficulty pronouncing Iranian names. I won't even try their last names because those are long. But anyway, these gals, about 10 years ago, were taken into an Iranian prison because they were followers of Jesus and they were telling others about Christ. And so they were taken into Evin prison in Iran, in Tehran. And they were taken there because, again, they were now enemies of the state. And the ladies were taken there. The whole world was very worried about them because this is a terrible place to be. And for 259 days, they spent time in Evin prison amidst a lot of international pressure from all over the world that was against Iran because they had taken these political prisoners. Now, the ladies, when they first got there, said at first, "We prayed for our release. But after a few days, we realized that by meeting with other women in the prison, some of them who had come in as homeless or addicts, God had given us the opportunity to share the message of Christ with them, and they needed to hear." And she said, "At first, when we were in this terrible location, we couldn't wait to get out, but now we figured, oh my, God's got some kind of massive plan for us while we're here right now." They said that first individuals came to them, and they didn't have any Bibles, so they just tried to live out the teachings of Christ. But individuals came to them, and they said, "You're the dirty Christians here." But she said, "After we continued to talk and minister, we have daily prayers, we would pray over people, we would try to help individuals as we could, and individuals came to them and apologized and said, 'We'd like to hear more.' Even there were prison guards that made their way to them and said, 'Can I tell you about my life? I want you to pray for me,' because they, again, said these ladies somehow had power. Circumstances beyond their control took them to prison, but something happened while they were there that was beyond anything they ever could have imagined." That's the story, again, of Mary and Joseph. Not their plan, not the ideal place where they wanted to have a baby. And yet it was part of the destiny of God that they would end up in Bethlehem. Let's move forward in the story, and I want you to notice in the birth narrative, there is the mention of a manger. And you know, I noticed this week. This story is very short and does not have many details. In fact, I want to show you again. Here's the verse. I just want to read it. While they were there, the time came for her to give birth, and so it's time for Mary to have her baby. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. That's it. That is all we get. Two verses about the birth of Jesus. There's a lot that we put around that, but that's all the scriptures have for us. Mary, no doubt, had no idea that she was going to give birth in Bethlehem. And she likely thought originally, I'm going to give birth to my baby. Every mother would think this. I'm going to give birth to my baby among family and friends. And just think about all the excitement that will be around that. And, you know, just think with me about what it feels like to be 9 months pregnant and to say, oh my, we have to now travel 80 miles outside of our city to another city that we don't really know very well, and we don't even know who's going to be there or what's going to happen. I mean, you know, again, I think about my wife when she was pregnant. She'd been a little miffed at that and a little afraid of that. I mean, how do you know what's going to happen on a journey of that magnitude? And so you're a little bit confused by all that. We are not given much about Mary's feelings or emotions. That is not what's told to us, but we do know that this young woman makes the trip, and we don't really know much about the birth itself. Was Joseph even there? Were there other women that are around her? Was there some woman that kind of served as a bit of a doula to her, or somebody that was, again, helping her with that birth? We don't know. No details around that. But we're told that Mary has this baby, and we're told that she is, again, laying this baby inside of a manger, and she's placing swaddling clothes around that baby. Now again, some modern translations say that he was wrapped in strips of cloth. And I listened to one pastor who says he's a little bit more of a traditionalist. And he said he's a radio guy or a podcast guy. And so somebody gave him this story, to read. And they gave it to him in a modern translation with strips of cloth around Jesus. And he said, I would rather eat rat poison then say the verses that way. I will say, and they wrap the baby in swaddling clothes, because that's the traditional way that's obviously come across. But some of you are saying, what is swaddling clothes? I don't even know what that is. Well, let me remind you what swaddling clothes are. I have some babies here that are in swaddling clothes. And swaddling means to be tightly wrapped. You can see those little babies are like they're in a little cocoon. And we had babies, and I can tell you, one of our babies loved to be swaddled, and one of our babies did not. She would kick off every cover ever put upon her. And so again, we're told that Jesus is swaddled, and in the ancient world, and still in many places today, that's thought to be a spot of comfort and security for a baby, as well as warmth for a baby. And so I think it's, again, saying a level of her care for her baby, that she is swaddling him and placing him in a manger. Now, I'm going to have a whole lot to say about the manger 2 days from now, on Christmas Eve. That's going to be my focus for that day. So I won't say much about that right now, but a manger is this. A manger is a place where you feed farm animals. A manger is the spot where it has the feed or it has water. And normally our mental model, in fact, we just had a screen up today that had the image of this. In fact, we were singing songs away in a manger, and that's what was up. That's probably not what the manger looked like. Wood was very scarce in all of Israel. And so again, this is probably what the manger looked like. It was stone. It had that carve out in it. And again, that one you could use forever and ever. I mean, that's never going to wear out. In fact, that's still a spot in Israel today where that is existing. So it didn't decay over 2,000 years because, again, it's made of that stone. That's probably what Jesus was in. We get the idea that he was in the equivalent of a barn because Jesus was placed in this manger, and that's what barn animals or farm animals are using as their feeding trough. And of course, this speaks to the extreme humility of Jesus as God's choice. And it's not the spot where you'd think a king would be born. And it's not the spot where any of our children would be born, among the animals. But that's where Jesus is born, and she lays him in a manger. So finally, we get to the spot in the story, and maybe the most controversial part of it, because it's the place where Jesus was born, and it's either, well, we're going to learn about the inn as well as the stable. And some of you might wonder, you're like, hey, I thought today we were going to hear about the individual who was the, you know, again, the villain of the story. We're going to hear about the individual that is, you know, this innkeeper. And it's like, Pastor, I think I've read the story, and I, you know, I don't see any innkeeper there. So, you know, what gives with this? Well, I think you need to hear about where this place was that Jesus went to, and you also need to get a sense for what it looks like today. So I'm going to slow roll this and unpack this for you. First of all, the spot today I've been to twice with individuals from church who've gone to Israel together. So we've been to Bethlehem, and you might imagine that over the spot where Jesus is thought to be born is a church today. In fact, if you walk into the church, this is what it's like on the inside of the church, and we're at the back where we're kind of in the pews here looking at this, and there is the altar, and you can see just how ornate it is. If you move to the right of this, there is a hallway that has a stairs that come down to the right over here and go up to the left. And so you come down the stairs. You wait in a long line, by the way, to get to that. And individuals are looking at the spot where the priest right there is looking down at the floor. And this is what he's looking at. There is the spot. You can see it's got kind of a star-like figure there. And that is thought to be the spot where Jesus is born. Now, why do you go downstairs to get to that? Well, because the ancient world was here, and it's built up over 2,000 years with all the other things. And so you go down to the original level at which Jesus would have been born at, and then you obviously have the church that's all around that today. Now, I bring that up again because we're told that there was no room for Jesus in the inn, or no room for Mary and Joseph in the inn. And so automatically you're thinking in your mind, well, an inn. We're thinking about, oh, there's no place for them in the Best Western Hotel. And there's no place for them in the Holiday Inn. And that's what crosses our minds. And so we're like, you know, that's probably what's going on, is there was no room for them at the hotel. But that's likely not what's happening here. There's something else that we have to further explore. Because this word inn can also be translated as guest house. And in fact, I want you to see the word. It's kataluma. Would you say that with me? 1, 2, 3. Kataluma. And that is a word that is pretty expansive. And here's what it can mean. It can mean inn or it can mean guest house, but it's a temporary place of rest for travelers. And so it's any place that you have set aside for travelers to come and stay with you. Some of you have guest houses in your own house. And so you would travel, you would have travelers that come to you, and you would have what's called a kataluma. Maybe you can say to guests on the way in, hey, why don't you come and stay in our kataluma? Because you would be a part of the ancient world and providing hospitality in that way. Now, here's what I want you to hear. Hospitality was a very high value in the ancient world. And so if you provided a place for travelers, especially family that you knew, but even individuals that just had need, you were doing something virtuous and something that would have been highly valued. And so perhaps it's not a hotel, but it's just a dwelling place for travelers where they were, and it may have very well been a portion of a home. Furthermore, it may not be as scandalous as we originally make it out to be. Luke was certainly saying this was a humble place, but Luke wasn't trying to rake anybody across the coals. We didn't read about anybody in the scriptures here that we're angry with or that have done anything wrong. And so this story may turn a lot more on what we imagine today than what actually happened at that time. We are, thinking that there's some kind of a great tragedy here, but there may have been something that was actually noble that was going on here. Perhaps the architecture of an ancient home would help us. And so I have a picture here of the way an ancient home was built. You have an ancient home that's got a courtyard in the middle. It's got a spot that's on the upper level where families would traditionally live and they would hang out. There was always some kind of an area where you would go up at night on that open air area, and where, your home's hot, but you'd go and cool off on that terrace area. There's a courtyard there. And what I want you to notice is far to the left is a spot where you would keep your domesticated animals. You would keep your sheep there. You might keep cows there. You might keep goats or, as it were, chickens that you even see, or ducks. And so you would keep them in that stable area that is underneath your home. In fact, if you travel around lots of Asia today, that's exactly the way it's still built today. The home is on the upper level, animals on the lower level, and that's all part of the symbiotic relationship between everybody. And so here's what I'm trying to argue today. I've perhaps changed my view a little bit of what's happening with the stable or the barn. And if that's what's happening, that they were actually put in the area with the animals, but it was part of the whole structure of the house, then maybe it's not something that is so bad. In fact, did you really want the pregnant woman at the upper floor with everybody kind of with gawking eyes and her moaning? It may have actually been a great comfort and a spot of a little bit of safety and seclusion for them to have been among the animals, and they could have, you know, some of their own privacy in the midst of all that happening. And so we make up, or I make up in my own mind, again, my anger, my guile at the guy who was the innkeeper who said there's no room at the inn. But in actuality, it may be something that was actually good. I imagine a scandal that may not even be there. The scriptures don't seem to indicate that there's a scandal there. It's just that Jesus is born among humble circumstance. We have to certainly acknowledge Mary and Joseph. They never imagined that's where they were going to be. And that's not the spot where they thought that it was probably the best. But it's where God would have Jesus to be born for some very important reasons. And they are fulfilling God's destiny at that moment. So what do we do with all of this? This young couple, far from home, in a unique life situation, but they've acted as agents of God for the purposes of God. Later in the chapter, Mary records, or Luke records, what Mary says, and it's something that's very interesting. It's after the shepherds have actually visited, and they've worshipped Jesus and found Jesus, and this is what the scriptures say. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. And so this is one of the times where the focus of the whole story gets into the emotion and the heart of Mary. And it doesn't say Mary was miffed because she gave birth to a baby in a barn. Mary was upset because she was so far from home. Mary, fill in the blank, it says Mary treasured all these things. It was a treasure for Mary to say, somehow, I have never had relations with my husband, but I've given birth to a baby. An angel visited me before this all happened, told me what was going to occur. I'm far from home, but somehow I'm the vessel or agent of God. And so here I am being used by God in this very moment. Here's my question for you. I'm wondering if we treasure what God is doing this Christmas. Perhaps there's some circumstances in your life that are less than perfect. I wonder if somehow they are still part of the purpose of God. I wonder if you can arrive at a space in which you say, somehow, I treasure this. Somehow, I'm treasuring what God is doing at this moment. Can I remind you about something? Jesus never promised to make life easier. There's not one passage in the scriptures that ever says, if you follow Jesus, life gets so much easier. In fact, I could go to a lot of passages in which life gets more difficult. It gets more difficult in following Jesus than not. So that's not what Jesus is promising here. He's coming into the world to be the perfect image of God, and he's on a rescue mission. He comes first of all to save in the sense of forgiving, rescuing from darkness. That's his charge. That's his plan. But then to turn the corner of that and to say, I'm changing you from the inside out. I'm conforming you to look like Jesus, and I'm preparing you for an eternity in heaven. That's the message. That's the plan of why Jesus enters the world as a baby. This Christmas, have you trusted Jesus as your Savior? And secondly, are you treasuring him in your life?